Was there a John that
they say which way to do it?
Wants to be added to our.
Which one? Municipal chair for Senator Benson.
A Scalzi one.
I was looking for her intake. Senator Benson doesn't have a name.
Benson. She's not high today.
Oh.
Yeah.
I
got it.
You got it? Okay. Yeah, I know.
This meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. We're planning to meet until 1:30 or a little bit after that. I'm not sure how long we have the room, and I don't want to go too far for committee members' sake. And then we are reconvening again at 4 o'clock in, I believe, in here as well. And with that, we're going to start out with Senator Dibble's bill, Senate File 1098. Welcome to the committee you sit on.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair and members, what Senate File 1098 seeks to do is build on our already very successful energy efficiency work that's going on, energy efficiency and conservation work that's going on in Minnesota, especially with respect to our investor-owned utilities in Minnesota. As you all no doubt know, because we have a lot of discussion about this in this committee, we have an overall goal, aspirational goal, in the state of Minnesota of saving 1.5% of our energy as construed by sales every year in Minnesota. And we've been successful at doing that. Part of what brings that aspirational goal to life is the Conservation Improvement Program and the energy efficiency filings, the resource plans, the certificates, need all that stuff that the energy companies, the IOUs, have to do in front of the PUC from time to time. And built into those plans are how they're going to achieve, particularly on the demand side, how they're going to achieve that sort of energy savings. In the last number of years, and we can provide more detail around this, we've saved a tremendous amount of energy. The materials I reviewed equate that to the equivalent of 9 power plants that we have not had to build in the last number of years. And so that saves a lot of money for utilities, and then by extension our ratepayers, because we're not paying to build those plants. That also means, of course, that that's energy that we haven't had to pay for on our bills itself. So we haven't had to pay for building those plants and all of the infrastructure associated with getting that energy to the users, and then the users themselves, of course, have foregone having to pay for that energy. So the requirements of our approach to conservation improvement programs is that they be cost effective. In other words, the effort that we go to encourage and incent energy savings has to be less than the amount that we actually save, and that's what we mean by cost effective. So we're not running around doing really, really expensive things that cost more than any energy that we could possibly deem as savings. Right now, we count. We ask utilities to try to achieve 1.5% in savings, both on the demand side and on the supply side, to the extent that they seek to save energy. On the supply side, that part would count above 1% to get up to the 0.5%. So what this bill seeks to do is encourage more activity, more effort on the supply side of the equation, on the other side of the meter than the customer. And it allows for a way of encouraging and incenting that through an enhanced rate of return. It identifies some eligible technology that right now isn't a part of the mix. It's, of course, as is true today, it's over and above some of the routine maintenance that utilities do from time to time. That does result in a little bit more efficiency. I mean, they clean up their generators, or they do things that they buff up their generation plants, and that does save a little bit of energy, but that's fairly standard routine. So as is true today, these are those projects that a utility would undertake, and I need to emphasize that we're talking only about investor-owned utilities, that would be result in energy savings over and above some of the routine activities. It moves up, so we call those energy optimization projects, and we ask the utilities to identify 0.5% savings year over year as a result of energy optimization projects. We add to this larger kind of statewide policy of 1.5%. We move that up to 2.0%. You can see that in section 2 on page 3. And then I'm just talking in broad brushstrokes here, and we can dive into details in a little bit if the committee so desires. We ask the department to assist with criteria and in evaluation and that sort of thing. Those are some of the details. But we the other big part of the bill is in section 5, in which we identify cogeneration projects, also known as combined heat and power, as one of the eligible technologies, one of the options that utilities can use. That's, of course, capturing excess heat, waste heat from the industrial process of generating electricity to generate additional energy. And like I said, it has to be cost effective. That's so key. And it allows for what we call an enhanced rate of return. So in other words, utilities can realize some of the savings that occur to them to help offset some of the capital effort that they go to install these technologies.
Nope.
All right. All right. So I think that's the broad brushstroke. We have some folks who can testify to why this is such a great idea, and maybe give you some of the technical details that I'm not as able to. Who's going to start? So Will Nissen from Fresh Energy is going to start off.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Will Nissen, and I'm a senior policy associate at Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a nonprofit energy policy advocacy organization, and we have over 20 years of experience supporting practical policies to increase the adoption of energy efficiency and renewable energy resources. And I'm also here speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Clean Energy and Jobs Campaign. And I'm going to go through why we support this bill, covering some of the things Senator Dibble mentioned. Energy efficiency programs in Minnesota have saved over $6.8 billion for residents and businesses over the last 20-plus years. As Senator Dibble mentioned, by avoiding the need to build 9 medium-sized power plants over that time, these programs have had a continual downward pressure on rates for all customers throughout the state. While these programs have traditionally focused on lowering energy use by the customer, there are opportunities for investments on the utility system to more efficiently generate and deliver that energy. However, these energy savings investments, like better voltage control, energy storage, or combined heat and power, are not happening for reasons that my colleague, Mr. Sullivan, will explain. So Senate File 1098 aims to preserve the existing after-the-meter or demand-side energy programs that have served our state so well, while expanding the framework for investor-owned utilities to invest in before-the-meter or supply-side efficiency measures. Importantly, the bill captures the need to implement these investments differently. Demand-side programs directly help residents and businesses use less energy while improving the value and quality of their buildings and delivering health benefits to those who live and work there. The supply-side investments that Senate File 1098 encourages will generate and deliver that energy to the end users more efficiently. And both of these policies benefit customers in the state and should be part of our state's energy savings efforts moving forward. But because these supply-side investments aren't happening, Senate File 1098 proposes to build on existing statute to create a new standard for investor-owned utilities to achieve a 0.5% annual energy savings from these investments. Implementing both customer-focused efficiency programs and supply-side efficiency investments will continue that downward pressure on rates that energy savings deliver to our state. Because we believe that energy savings are the cheapest and cleanest energy resource we have here in Minnesota, we believe we should be maximizing that resource across our state and across our economy. So therefore, as Senator Dibble mentioned, Senate File 1098 proposes to increase the state's energy savings goal to 2% annual energy savings In statute, this can be achieved through a variety of means, both within and outside utility activities. And this is a non-binding, aspirational goal that sends the right message for the state of Minnesota. And finally, Senate File 1098 nudges the ball forward on how combined heat and power might fit into our conservation improvement programs and creates a framework for how non-utility-owned CHP could work in those programs, yet it does not require any utility to offer combined heat and power SIP programs. And lastly, we've appreciated the feedback we've received on this bill. We've talked to a number of stakeholders, and we look forward to continue working with those stakeholders to make this bill as the best that it can be and move forward from there. So thank you very much, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nissen. Senator Scalzi and Senator Brown.
Mr. Nissen, does your bill affect, does this bill affect munis or co-ops? Because we sometimes hear from them quite a bit.
Senator Marty, Senator Scalzi, no, there is, we've specifically targeted this bill to the investor-owned utilities, and this bill does not require the cooperative or municipal utilities to do anything.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, I think I heard you say that the investor-owned utilities aren't making these investments, and that's one of the reasons for this legislation. Why do you think it is they aren't making these investments, according to how you view it?
Mr. Nissen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I will leave that to my colleague, Mr. Sullivan, to answer in his testimony.
All right.
Then are we ready for Mr. Sullivan? You're going to go next?
Sure. Okay. I'm ready.
And I hope you can address Senator Brown's question as part of your testimony or else as a question afterwards.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. It's my pleasure to testify in support of Senate File 1098. And thank you to Senator Dibble for carrying this legislation. Senator Brown, your question is really kind of the critical point here. So thank you for raising it. I'll answer it and just give me a minute. But I'll start first by introducing, I'm Joe Sullivan. I'm with Center for Energy and Environment. CEE is a nonprofit business. We've been in Minneapolis. We're based in Minneapolis. We work throughout the state. There's about 100 people who work at CEE. 50% of us are engineers and PhDs, really kind of smart folks who are working on cutting-edge research around energy efficiency, but primarily on the demand side, on the customer side of the meter. We've worked with utilities for a long time, 35 years we've been around. And again, our focus is largely been on the demand side. But the answer to your question, Senator Brown, and starts with why efficiency doesn't happen automatically or organically on the electric system. And you know, it really fundamentally boils down to the electric utilities, you know, as regulated utilities, as regulated monopolies. You know, there is no incentive for them to sell less less electricity. So, what Minnesota has done, and we've done very successfully, is we have put state goals in place and spending requirements and goals for the electric utilities to encourage demand side or customer sided efficiency. So I have a programmable thermostat, and that programmable thermostat saves me a lot of money, and it's been good for my house. So the focus of our programs have up to now really largely been on demand side, and it's paid off. You know, our DSM programs, our conservation improvement programs, have been very successful. This is all done through cost effective investments. You know, 9 power plants have not been built on Xcel system. If you include the other utilities, it would be even more. You know, billions of dollars in ratepayer savings. But kind of switching over into kind of why are we looking at these certain efficiencies on the supply side? And the reason is it's analogous to why we do demand side efficiency. There is no incentive for the most part, supply-side efficiency upgrades happen automatically. Another definition for supply-side efficiency is just system maintenance. The utilities are constantly updating their system. They're constantly maintaining their system. You know, there might be 100 or 1,000 capital requests every year to maintain the distribution system, the supply system, and the generation system. But there are certain targeted supply-side efficiency upgrades that don't happen. And those don't happen because specifically because the utility loses an electric sale. They lose a kilowatt-hour sale. So it's analogous to why we've done DSM for the last 35 years, the last 30 years, is we're trying to target those efficiency upgrades which would be good for ratepayers, are good for ratepayers, through a targeted incentive structure plus a goal that kind of goes in and specifically looks at things like better voltage control in the distribution system. And I think that voltage control is the best example. You know, voltage control, voltage degrades over a distribution system. And if you can lower the voltage through better system controls, you can actually back down the power at the power plant and have really significant savings. There's great examples from large utilities like Con Edison in Illinois and Sacramento Municipal Electric Utility where they've done just this. They've seen pretty significant savings. And from the perspective of the rate payer, they don't know anything differently. They've used all their appliances are using the, you know, coming on and going off at the same time. But the benefit is that you can actually, if you have lower voltage, you actually use a little bit less electricity. Why the utility doesn't do that right now is because it means that they actually sell less electrons. And it's not in their best interest. It's not in their regulated utility. It's not in their interest to sell less electrons. So that's why the upgrade doesn't happen. And those are the specific things that we'd be looking at. Other examples would be like combined heat and power, where you're using steam from an industrial process to fire a generator. Again, the same, it's really a business model issue why it doesn't happen. The utility business model is not suited for reducing electric sales. So I hope that is a long way of answering your question, but I hope it did. So really in conclusion, that's why we support it. CEE largely supports demand-side management and customer-sided efficiency, but we really view the entire system as something that should be at its most and highest efficiency, because in our view, that's best for the economy. If we are not spending extra money on electricity, then we're using that is a higher and more productive use of our own capital, and that goes back and helps build our economy. And that's really fundamentally the reason why energy efficiency is a good thing. So, and those are my comments. Thank you.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Sullivan, are you saying that unless the legislature incentivizes the investor-owned utilities to be efficient, that they have no reason to go down that road?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, the utility, what I'm saying is, I don't know if I would use that terminology. I think that the utility as a regulated utility is not incentivized to encourage efficiency on behalf of its customers, its ratepayers. There's always a constant churn on the supply side of as they, you know, build a new boiler or they put new transformers in. Those will always be more efficient. But in terms of efficiency that reduces an electric sale, the utilities are not incentivized to do that type of efficiency. Hope that answers the question.
Mr. Chair, it seems to me if investor-owned utilities didn't have to build an additional 9 power plants, that seems like a pretty good incentive for me for them to find ways of efficiency. Am I wrong in my thinking?
Mr. Sullivan. Senator Dibble.
Senator Marty, Senator Brown, those 9 power plants that we didn't build didn't happen by magic on the initiative of utilities all of their own accord. We've had conservation efficiency programs for quite a while, and then a few years ago, of course, we took a step up and made those a little more aggressive than we had in the past. So the short answer to your question is not internal to the rate-regulated monopoly investor-owned utilities do these things happen by themselves, whether on the demand side or the supply side. So I guess the answer to your question is, you know, is in the affirmative. You know, these things, these are monopoly regulated industries that have specific goals that are set forth by policy and by regulation.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, because of these programs and we haven't had these nine plants being built and the energy you've talked about that we've saved, have we seen the CO2 levels decrease because of all of this?
Senator Marty, Senator Brown, of course. Of course there's not as much carbon dioxide in the air as there would be otherwise.
Further question? Okay, you have other witnesses as well. Ken Smith from Evergreen and Bob Ryan.
Chair.
I know. I got that one over there, too.
Welcome to the committee. Go ahead, either one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Ken Smith. I'm President CEO of Evergreen Energy and also I'm the current chair of the International District Energy Association. And I have some prepared remarks I'd like to share with you about the Senate File 1098. According to the U.S. Department of Energy's most recent data, the current overall efficiency of the U.S. energy system is approximately 40%. And the power generation sector has been stuck at approximately 35% efficiency for decades. And according to the DOE, U.S. Minnesota's picture pretty much is a mirror of the national results. This level of inefficiency means that for every 100 units of energy to generate electricity, approximately 65% is wasted, and much of that in the form of heat or thermal energy. As awareness about the inefficiencies of our energy system has grown, interest in combined heat and power as a strategy has also grown due to its proven ability to increase efficiency, reduce fossil fuel consumption, and reduce carbon emissions. And increasingly, combined heat and power is becoming a foundational element to energy strategies globally. As current chair of the International District Energy Association, I've had the opportunity to learn about energy efficiency strategies in several other countries. A common thread exists in countries such as Germany, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, South Korea, China, the United Kingdom, and even our neighbors to the north in Canada. All are expanding the use of combined heat and power. During three recent visits to Germany with Lieutenant Governor Pretner Solem, it was noted in every community we visited, from villages of 400 residents in Feldheim to Berlin, a city of nearly 4 million residents, combined heat and power was in use. Recently, the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy reports indicate that CHP is growing in the U.S. as well. In light of the University of Minnesota's recent decision to add CHP on the Twin Cities campus, one location I want to highlight is University of Texas, Austin. UT Austin economically co-generates through multiple combined heat and power plants all of the electricity for the campus at an efficiency of 88%. They achieve this level of efficiency by integrating the generation of electricity with the production of all the thermal energy needed for heating and cooling buildings on the campus. The reliability and carbon reduction results they have achieved are tremendous as well. The use of combined heat and power is also increasingly being deployed to increase grid reliability and resiliency. In the aftermath of the 2012 Superstorm Sandy, multiple stories emerged in media sources such as the New York Times and Forbes magazine about where the power and heat stayed on and where service was rapidly restored in the aftermath. The impressive resiliency of the energy systems using combined heat and power systems in multiple settings such as Princeton University, Co-op City in New York City and the Bronx, which is the largest residential development in the United States, and South Oaks Hospital in Long Island have caused states like New York, Connecticut, and Massachusetts to expand the use of combined heat and power to increase the local resiliency of electrical and thermal grids. While combined heat and power is being used in Minnesota, a variety of reports indicate that there is significant potential to expand its use even more. Successful integration of combined heat and power requires collaboration and partnership among several parties. It takes integrating power generation with a suitable thermal host, such as a hospital, or an industrial facility, or a district heating and cooling system that serves a college and university campus, an industrial park, or a central business district. It is that way that we maximize efficiency and environmental benefits and the project economics. Minnesota has long been a leader in smart, cost-effective, demand-side energy efficiency policy and results. And it's time to expand our great work we have accomplished in partnership on the demand side to the supply side of the equation. It's for this reason that I offer these remarks and your support of SF 1098.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Ryan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Marty, members of the committee. My name is Bob Ryan. I'm with the United Steelworkers, District 11. I'm here to speak with you about spurring more energy efficiency in a way Minnesota can create and secure more good jobs. Already there are over 15,000 workers in Minnesota's clean economy, and 63% of those jobs are in energy efficiency. One of the reasons for this growth is the Energy Efficiency Resource Standard, or EERS, we adopted in our state. Today I'm here to ask you to improve this current standard from 1.5% to 2% for investor-owned utilities to promote the growth of family-sustaining jobs, make our industries more competitive, and to save money in the long run. Modern technologies like combined heat and power and energy storage can be used to meet this improved standard. Combined heat and power, or CHP, is a technology that utilizes heat that would otherwise be wasted by capturing it and using it to heat buildings or even generate more power. Minnesota ranks 23rd in terms of CHP projects installed since 2005 in the U.S., and the U.S. Department of Energy reports that CHP represents 5.2% of our total generating capacity. That's below the national average of 8%. So we certainly have room to grow, and improving the EERS will certainly help us do that. A 2% EERS will not only help prevent more energy waste, it will continue to put downward pressure on rates for both consumers and businesses. You two members, we care deeply about the environment. We care about the lasting legacy that we leave to our future generations. And by improving the EERS and implementing other smart policies, we can help secure that legacy. As many of you know, I come from a very large industrial user of energy, the Rock 10 paper mill, 3 miles down the avenue. And because of our energy efficiencies and combined heat and power, we've cut our operating cost by 30% and still produce over 1,000 tons of recycled paper a day. So these plans do work and they are efficient. To sum it up, improving the EERS will grow good jobs in our state, reduce pollution and waste, make our industries more competitive, and ensure that we leave future generations of Minnesotans a cleaner environment and a stronger economy. I urge you to do the right thing, supporting Senate File 1098, by improving the state's EERS from 1.5 to 2% for investor-owned utilities. Thank you for this opportunity to address the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan. Senator Rosen, did you have your hand up?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chair, but perhaps right. My comments are for Mr. Nessen.
Okay, we'll get that in a minute then. Questions for either of these two. Mr. Ryan, did you say Rock 10's combined heat and power was how much savings?
Amongst our efficiency standards that we did, we've cut our energy usage by 30%, and CHP being a large portion of it.
Okay. So in other words, it wasn't all of the 30%. That's a whole range of things you're doing.
A lot of things. They just relamped the entire complex with LEDs, thereby reducing the need by another 7%.
Thank you. Any further questions? We'll get to maybe Mr. Nissen after we have the other testimony as well, if that's okay. Thank you both. Mr. Logtug and Ms. Bergen, want to start? I assume, just going down the list I have here, I don't care if people have different.
Get them through more quickly that way.
Welcome to the committee. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Lauren Logtug from Otter Tail Power Company in Fergus Falls. And I am here today to speak against Senate File 1098. I regret that I can't speak in favor of Senator Dibble's bill. Senator Dibble's name has been on my bill jackets in the past whenever he thought there was a chance for improved air efficiency, cleaner air. So I'm here to speak against the bill, but I'm I'm thankful that Senator Dibble is bringing forth ideas. Senate File 1098 seeks to modify in its first section Minnesota Statutes 216B.1636. The purpose of 216B.1636 is to allow utilities to include what we call T&D, transmission and distribution investments, in reaching our energy efficiency goal. Energy utility infrastructure is the big term used. And the sorts of things that qualify for that are, for example, smart metering, which provides dynamic two-way communication between the utility and its customers, smart grid investments, distribution automation. And those are fairly high-tech and pricey investments on the part of utility. My company has not begun investing in those things yet. We're not going to be the first to do that. The co-op that, of which I'm a member, does have smart meters, so-called, and they can read my meter remotely. I can go on my computer and I can see my usage from last month, or I think even last week, hour by hour, day by day. But my company's not done that yet. The purpose overall of electric utility infrastructure investments is, in lines 1.18 to 1.20, to conserve energy or use energy more efficiently. The result of the proposed language for so-called the phrase used here is energy optimization, but its result is not primarily to conserve energy, but from my company's perspective, it creates a goal for a new source of energy, a source that's at the customer site. Now, my company is not unfamiliar with combined heat and power. Actually, at our Big Stone plant in near Milbank, South Dakota, we do sell steam to an ethanol plant next door known as Poet. And so they use our waste steam that overall improves the efficiency of the generation process. That's very true. But we think of this as a generation asset, not a T&D asset, transmission distribution. Now, let me say first, Otter Tail is not opposed to cogeneration, and we're certainly not opposed to energy efficiency or conservation. Energy efficiency and conservation as defined is, as has been said in other contexts, our most energy effective asset for new sources. It must meet tests for cost effectiveness, however, and our concern is that as the bill is constructed, we don't know for sure exactly which tests of customer effectiveness what need to be met. It creates here a new class of utility-owned assets that are purchased and maintained for the benefit of all utility customers. And in a utility rate case, these assets would be considered used and useful for all customers. These are assets on which shareholders could earn a return, as has been mentioned, and even a bonus return. So that's a plus from the utility perspective. However, the assets, from our experience, are not cost-effective. They're certainly not cost-effective for all ratepayers. Question I have for proponents would be this. Have there been studies done of cogeneration and combined heat and power for the potential for these technologies? There is actually a CHP task force, work group, stakeholder group that meets, and they've met, I believe, through the summer and the fall, and an organization called FVB Energy did do a combined heat potential a study of the state of Minnesota, and what they discovered is that there is very little potential for combined heat and power statewide, and in greater Minnesota, the paybacks tend to be up in the 10-year-plus range. We typically don't invest in 10-year-plus range investments, and so for that reason, utilities, we already include combined heat and power projects in our integrated resource plans that we file with the Public Utilities Commission and that are reviewed by the Department of Commerce. We think this places us in the role of venture capitalist for all utility ratepayers. Investments in uneconomic assets are not our specialty. And if something happens to the steam off-taker, for example, and we've invested in an asset at that location, then the risk borne for recovering the cost for an asset that's not performing or is written off becomes, that's an asset cost that's borne by all ratepayers and not just by a few. In most cases of cogeneration, the risk is borne by the customer who installs cogeneration. So we have here an annual goal. I won't call it a mandate, but goals do tend to be mandates over time. And the goal, since it's a 0.5% per year goal, if you compound that over 20 years, that actually is about an 11% mandate, if you want to think of it in the context of the 25 by 25 or in Excel's case 20 by 30. So it's an 11% mandate, or it's 11% goal over a period of 20 years. Last question I'd like to ask is, the EPA has proposed Rule 111D in the Clean Air Act, and I suspect that what's proposed here will be a part of the discussions in the stakeholder group that's being undertaken now, and that this would be one of the things that's included in a state implementation plan that the public or that the PCA presents to the EPA. So with that in mind, I think it's a bit early to do a 0.5% goal or mandate for combined heat and power and cogeneration. And in fact, if we raise our goal to 2%, all that we do between now and the year 2000, at least as the currently proposed plan is, nothing new that we do from here until 2020 gets included in our performance that we need to achieve by 2030 in EPA's proposed plan. Mr. Chair, that's all I've got. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Ms. Weifel.
Chairman Marty and members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Weifel, and I first want to apologize. I am not Deb Bergen, as the agenda would indicate. She is in Washington, D.C. at the APPA rally this week, and I apologize for forgetting to let Barb know about the switch out. I am here on behalf of Missouri River Energy Services, which is a municipal power agency located in Sioux Falls with 61 municipal electric member communities, 24 of which are in the state of Minnesota. Now, I'm guessing the first question all of you have is, why is a municipal power agency testifying against a bill that's primarily aimed at investor-owned utilities? And there's two basic reasons. The first is that what we've typically seen with Minnesota law is that when something first applies to IOUs, later the municipals often get brought into it. So we like to express concerns early on to make sure things are shaped correctly. The second is that we actually do believe that there is a change in the bill specifically to the goal that may have impact us at the agency. And I'm going to go to that first. We are concerned about increasing the state's overall CIP goal to 2%. Now, we understand that change is just in the goal, and it doesn't appear in this section on certificates of need or integrated resource plan, but it does set up a scenario where agencies and interveners will maybe try to push for 2% before any certificate of needs or IRPs are approved. We've seen this happen with 216H, which establishes a statewide goal of greenhouse gas reductions for all sectors of the economy, yet in the utility IRPs, the MPUC and DOC are questioning how utilities are going to meet those goals for the entire state. Therefore, we are worried about how this increasing the CIP goal would play out in those agency proceedings. I do want to point out that Missouri River has been very proactive in trying to meet its CIP goals. In 2008, when it started working on this, Missouri River Energy Service member utilities spent $2.6 million on energy efficiency programs, and that achieved a savings of about 0.6%. 5 years later, by 2013, that spending went up to $4 million, I think it's about a 40% increase, but the savings only went up to 0.9%. When we're changing the goal, it's really important that folks remember that municipal utilities operate programs to encourage customer investments in efficiency. We can't mandate customer change or investment. We can only encourage it. And to encourage that higher participation, we have to make higher financial investments. And those investments are simply additional costs for our not-for-profit utilities and their customers. If we have to increase rates to pay for the additional incentives, those rate increases are typically regressive because of the way that utility rates are in a municipal utility situation. And then those increased rates typically fall on those who are least able to afford it, which means that they have lower disposable income, in turn less money to spend on further efficiency investment. So we think that we don't agree with trying to raise the goal to 2%. The second thing we just want to comment is that while it may be good to count infrastructure projects as part of CIP, we don't think that they should appear as a separate or additional 0.5% mandate. And we think that all energy efficiency savings, regardless of which side of the meter they occur, should be included. Like I think Mr. Lautog pointed out, as we go forward with the Federal Clean Power Plan, we think it's really important to make sure that our CIP programs and savings coordinate with what counts with the CPP. So, again, we just want to state that we are concerned and opposed to this bill and want to thank you for your time and consideration today.
Thank you, Ms. Wade. Any questions from members of the committee? Thank you very much. We have Joel Johnson, Ben Gerber, and Rick Evans next. Chris Spenningsby as well. I'm sorry, I missed that. So if you want to, I didn't mean to call out of order. Go ahead, either one of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joel Johnson. I'm with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. We represent the 44 distribution co-ops and the 6 generation and transmission co-ops that provide them power. First, I'd like to thank the author and the advocates here for recognizing that there is a difference between utilities. And I understand that, you know, the reason that co-ops and munis were excluded from this legislation for the most part was because of a recognition that that meeting the existing 1.5% goal has been much more difficult for us. That's because of the, you know, significant variations in demographics, load growth, and usage patterns among utilities. We also like the idea of focusing more on the system side savings, though we do wish that we would get rid of the distinctions. We tend to believe that a kilowatt hour saved is a kilowatt hour saved, whether it's on the customer side of the meter or on the system side, and particularly for co-ops, which have a much higher investment level in poles, in transformers, in wires. We think that we can get better bang for our buck if we were to make investments that improved our efficiencies on that side, rather than chasing savings that are already going to occur among our members through rebates or other things. We do have concerns with increasing the 2% goal. We have seen repeatedly that the PUC uses these goals, which are put into statute, as the basis for rulings. We've seen that repeatedly over the past few years, and increasingly so. And finally, before we start increasing conservation goal in the state, I think we need to have a broader goal over what's taking place in conservation. You know, right now, after doing some studies within our service territories about the potential for savings, we have real worries that even more and more distribution co-ops are going to have trouble meeting the 1.5% goal overall. And that's because a lot of there are a number of changes in the dwindling potential for savings due to increases in efficiency in lighting, motors, and appliances over the past 2 decades. And we're also seeing a large increase in the amount of conservation taking place outside of the utility purview. And I think before we start increasing the goals that we're going to be putting on our utilities, that we need to really get a better understanding of how much conservation is taking place in the state, and if there are perhaps better ways of encouraging that conservation than through utility programs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Spenningsby, Supervisor of Project Development for Minnesota Power, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill and Minnesota Power's experience with combined heat and power. Minnesota Power has extensive experience working to optimize the efficiency of its assets and supporting its customers to provide energy optimization projects and energy efficient measures which are both affordable and reliable. Minnesota Power has owned and operated combined heat and power facilities at its Rapids Energy Center, Cloquet Energy Center, and Hibbard Renewable Energy Center for many years, providing process steam to key paper customers, as well as industrial distributed electric generation to serve its large power requirements. While Minnesota Power continues to assess opportunities to provide cogeneration and other utility infrastructure solutions, many potential projects have not been implemented due to the risk of stranded assets if the customer host were to go out of business or experience a significant reduction in operational demand, and sometimes the poor cost benefit of studied projects. Additionally, the current regulatory framework to evaluate energy efficiency projects such as combined heat and power challenges the cost feasibility of cost recovery for utility-owned CHP projects. For example, in December 2012, Minnesota Power requested the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission to approve transferring assets from the company's Rapids Energy Center combined heat and power plant from a non-regulated operation into regulated operation and to approve expenditures for optimization projects to increase biomass cogeneration at the site. The request was denied primarily because the commission agreed with the Department of Commerce, which argued that the cost of the company's power from regulated operations was marginally higher with the combined heat and power within its rate base than without the plant, even though the cost difference was notably small. Consequently, this low-cost facility remains part of Minnesota Power's non-regulated business and planned combined heat and power expansions at the company that the company had been considering are on hold. In order for future company-owned energy optimizations projects to be successful, the regulatory framework for evaluating these projects should support their implementation. Minnesota Power agrees with a thoughtful policy that encourages these projects, but does not support mandating utilities to add a specific number of energy optimization projects as required by Senate File 1098. The company believes that any project must be reasonably cost-effective and in the best interest of its customers. Mandating a certain number of projects which are not reasonably cost-effective or located on high-risk sites are not needed and are not in the best interest of its customers. Cogeneration and energy optimization projects vary considerably and should be evaluated on a site-by-site basis. Additionally, many projects require the consent of a host customer. Customers cannot be forced to do these projects if they do not want to or if they're not in their best financial interest. While Minnesota Power supports policies which promote energy optimization and cogeneration projects, there are several concerns with the proposed policy options in this bill, including the recommendation to add supply-side cogeneration projects to the Conservation Improvement Program. There are fundamental differences between promoting energy conservation, which is a current goal of CIP, and encouraging generation efficiency. A basic premise of conservation is that the costly utility investment in future generation or future transmission infrastructure can be deferred, a principle that does save money for all customers. Promoting cogeneration projects will add generation at a potentially higher cost than existing generation, and that will need to be paid for by all the customers. Projects within existing CIP program cannot legitimately be compared with cogeneration projects since the cost savings ratios are fundamentally different. Reducing energy usage is always more cost effective than adding efficiency to energy production. Another difference between CIP programs and cogeneration programs is that the savings from CIP projects utilize a first-year savings reporting measure, while savings calculations for cogeneration projects are often measured in many years, decades. Additionally, the most economic projects are likely the very large projects, which could dwarf existing CIP budgets. Adding a separate tier or option for cogeneration within existing CIP programs would require significant upfront costs to administer the program and to evaluate projects, even if no projects are ultimately accepted. And even when projects are accepted, the timeline for completion is considerably longer than traditional CIP projects, further compounding the impact of CIP budgets. Further, it has been a basic premise of the CIP that programs and projects that give primacy to customer projects and that they are available to all eligible customer classes. This bill could have unintended consequences that tilt the focus away from a broad-based, diversified approach currently employed towards more niche, deferred projects or technology approaches. Given the ebb and flow of cogeneration projects, inclusion in CIP would likely result in erratic performance with exceedingly high savings in certain years and high cost in other years. Minnesota Power agrees with policies to provide tools and encourage adoption of CHP or cogeneration projects, but does not support mandating utilities to add these projects or including them in CIP. The company has extensive experience working with its customers to provide cogeneration opportunities and continues to assess opportunities to provide these solutions as part of an overall resource planning process. We appreciate the opportunity to comment on Senate File 1098.
Thank you, Mr. Spenningby. I had a question about what you were saying about that one project that you were trying to get into the regulated business as opposed to the other side. What was the reason they gave for not including it in?
The cost with that project in our regulated utility rate base was marginally higher than if it wasn't. So it was a higher cost resource than what was available with other options.
Maybe I have a question for Senator Dibble on that then, or one of your witnesses. I thought your requirement was that the projects, in order to do this, if the utility didn't have any cost-effective investments they could do in what you're calling energy optimization, they're not allowed to do ones that aren't, and if they didn't have any they could do, that's what I thought, that they weren't doing them then.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Yeah, cost-effective is a bedrock principle. And I'll also add, if I can respond quickly, nothing in this bill mandates that utilities implement combined heat and power. This is just an eligible technology and a methodology by which determining cost effectiveness with all stakeholders at the table to help figure that out is also a requirement of the bill.
Any other questions for Mr. Spangsby? Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I think what I'm hearing the testifier bring up is something that, you know, there's some deeper issues here with the one-size-fits-all kind of methodology that I'm hearing you say, and lack of flexibility on optimizing, you know, a site-by-site cogeneration, because it's going to, and I always wondered that, why is it a one-size-fits-all when you have different needs in different areas, and we have such a fragmented energy system in Minnesota anyway. It's like, I wish we could all just get together in one big room and sing a song, you know. It's like, but you're raising some deeper concerns and questions, and I'm glad, Senator Dilley, you're bringing this. I did hear that there are some issues of mandates, and I also did hear about, you know, when you set the bar, all of a sudden, you know, the feds are going to go, well, look where Minnesota's at. So instead of being parity with everybody else, we're just going to jack them up higher. So there's some deeper questions and concerns that I think I have, And I'm glad you brought this up about the one size fits all, which I think is an issue if we look at this.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Dibble.
So the room in which people will get together and sing, Senator Hoffman, you can find on starting on line 7.24, where the commissioner is going to get everyone in a room, and a choir director and some sheets of music and. There won't be one size fits all. Matter of fact, earlier on in that same section, says that you know, these things can't be counted unless the conservation plan is approved. So that's cost effective and all these things.
Thank you, Mr. Spangby. Mr. Gerber and Mr. Evans, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Benjamin Gerber. I represent the chamber. You'll hear, I'll let Rick Evans go next. I think he has a better singing voice, so he'll have me singing. But I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward, and thank you to Senator Dibble And I'm here to express some concerns about the bill, and I have been working with, and I appreciate that the proponents of the bill have been open to taking some suggestions, but I think one important thing to start off with here is, from my wearing my ratepayer hat for a second, I mean, it's very rare that you would have utilities, and we just heard a bunch of utilities opposing something that would actually give them an enhanced rate of return. And I think that should show you that there's some real problems with the way that the bill is structured. And I think you really should think about that. We're actually saying, and we have a concern about that, what does an enhanced rate of return mean, and why should we give a higher rate of return than we normally give for something? But you actually have different groups, and I think they've done a good job addressing why, but actually opposing paying them more money to do this. And I think that that's rare, and that's something that we should think about as you think about the problems with the bill. I think also to address the issue that was just brought up, that this is not a mandate, but when you look at lines 2.4, I mean, the utilities must include this. And from my limited experience at the commission over the last 3 years, these are treated as a mandate. And it's unlikely that a utility wouldn't be required to make investments if they didn't come close to hitting their conservation target. So I think while it isn't technically a mandate, it operates exactly like one. And so therefore, and I think in my mind, it actually is a mandate. I think one of the concerns that we have, too, is just there's a lot of, we believe the chamber, there's a lot of problems in the current SIT model. We have one of the highest incentive mechanisms in any other state. There was a utility recently within their recovery filing. 70% of their overall budget was actually for their shareholder incentive, not even for the investments. So there's a lot of things I think that we need to fix first. I think putting something new on top of that really doesn't address the current problem. And then there's the issue, I think we heard, and it's important to reiterate, conservation is conservation. It doesn't matter if it's on the supply side or the demand side. And so we should be making sure that whatever we do is cost effective. One of the concerns we've had from the chamber's perspective as well is that once you actually include that incentive mechanism and back into the cost benefit analysis, a lot of these projects aren't actually cost effective for the consumers. And so I think that's something we need to think about before we go ahead with this. And I'm going to keep talking with the proponents, and I appreciate it. And on the cogeneration piece, I think is obviously really important to the chamber. We've been active in Xcel's last rate case on promoting combined heat and power, and actually Senator Dibble is the author of Senate File 1357, which to the chamber is a very important bill about lifting the cap on natural gas combined heat and power facilities. So I think hopefully that bill will have a hearing in the Senate and the House this year, and we'll also get that passed. I know members of this committee are on that bill. And so that's another piece of legislation we think that will help increase cogen, but we think there are some problems right now with this.
Thank you. Questions from Mr. Gerber? Mr. Evans.
excuse me. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. Just a couple of things I'd like to say preliminarily. First is we do also read this, the way this legislation is drafted, as an imposition of a mandate. I'm happy to hear Senator Dibble say that that's not his intention. I think we're going to have to take another look at the language and find out why we have that difference of opinion. And it may be just as simple as what Mr. Gerber said, which is that the Public Utilities Commission will treat this as a mandate. When words like must are used, I think the Public Utilities Commission tends to take that very seriously. The other thing that I would mention is that, and I believe one of the earlier testifiers mentioned this, we have Rule 111D coming down the road. I hate to be a broken record on this, but energy conservation is one of the building blocks of Rule 111D. We're a little more than a year out from the state implementation plan that will tell us how we are supposed to do that. And so I think it would be premature to be working with the changing our conservation improvement program at this point until we see the outcome of that process. But mostly what I wanted to talk about today was the combined heat and power. While I understand that Mr. Sullivan stressed things like voltage control, the fact is voltage control, I guess I'll disagree with Mr. Sullivan. The reason we don't do some of the supply side improvements in efficiency has got nothing to do with losing sales to customers. While there is some impact on sales to customers, just by definition, it's on the supply side of the meter. It's not on the other side of the meter. The problem with much of the much of those kinds of improvements is they're very expensive. And we spent $86 million last year in conservation programs at Xcel Energy. And those are balanced against all the other things that we could do with that money that would save energy. And what we find is that the supply side of the meter conservation is far more cost effective. And that's the reason we do it. It's really not because we have any fear of losing sales. And so what I think this bill really does, which is very significant, is it puts combined heat and power in the middle of the SIP program. Let's make no mistake here. We're talking about building fossil fuel power plants. That's what combined heat and power involved. It's got nothing to do with the current fleet of power plants. This inserts into the SIP program what we would consider to be a mandate to build fossil fuel power plants. Now, I don't want anyone to come away from this thinking that we are opposed to combined heat and power. Combined heat and power is a significant thing. It's something the state ought to look at very closely. A couple of weeks ago, we had Kurt Hager here from our resource planning department who talked about our resource plan. He talked about how we have designed our next resource plan to focus on renewable energy because we don't want to become dependent on fossil fuel natural gas energy. Because when we, as we work into the next resource plan, we're going to have to worry about this some more. And so there was a very intentional consideration given in our last resource plan, our current resource plan, to moving towards renewable energy as opposed to shifting everything to natural gas. Combined heat and power is a resource planning decision. It should not be in the 0.5% SIP requirement as we move forward. And just so you know, there's no reason you would know, but in 2012, the Public Utilities Commission ordered us to consider combined heat and power in our resource plan. We took that very seriously. I think most of you got a copy of the summary of our resource plan. We tried to have that passed out today. If you look on page 34 and 35 of the summary, you'll see a detailed description of the analysis that we made of combined heat and power and how it could be incorporated into our plan. And one of the important things that you'll read there is that, and I'll quote it, we believe there may be a role for CHP in the future of the NSP system as a strategy to promote efficient system operation, reduce CO2 emissions, and expand options available to customers. However, in order to incorporate CHP as a viable technology, there must be a rational and cost-effective strategy for its expansion on the NSP system. In 2014, and you've heard reference to this, the Department of Commerce held a series of stakeholder engagement meetings on the potential for CHP deployment, et cetera. This is something the Department of Commerce and Xcel and a bunch of other stakeholders are currently studying as a part of the resource plan process to incorporate CHP in the resource plan, which is where it belongs. I think I also passed out the study that was done by the Microgrid Institute, which was a part of the Department of Commerce study. And as you can see on page 16 of that document, there's a CHP action plan. Could lead towards substantial improvement to Minnesota's energy economy in three ways. But the action plan requires the establishing clear strategic goals for deployment of CHP in Minnesota in the context of the state's emerging energy future vision, as well as its economic, environmental, and security goals. So if there's a concern that CHP is not being considered by all the stakeholders and by the Department of Commerce, let me put the concern to rest. This is an ongoing study. The final plan, the draft of the CHP action plan, is due from the department later this month. There's going to be a webinar and a comment period where the stakeholders can comment on the action plan. There's a final CHP action plan that will be released in April. and then there are further discussions and stakeholder engagement through the end of the year to put together the comprehensive strategic plan for the deployment of combined heat and power. I'll leave you with this thought. We should not start dumping what on our system would be 20 megawatts of combined heat and power year after year after year after year onto our system, fossil fuel plants deployed around the state, until we have completed the comprehensive strategic plan that the Department of Commerce is currently running.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is to the bill's author, Senator Dibble. Senator, could you tell me again, did you say you do not see this bill as a mandate?
Let me get back up to that.
I was actually going to have some questions for both of you two and the other two, and Mr. Nissen and Mr. Sullivan. I know we don't have enough chairs, but maybe if the four of you stay there with Senator Dibble, we may have a few questions yet. So, Senator Brown, go ahead.
So I heard the question. Senator Marty, Senator Brown. The way the CIP filings work is we ask the utilities, the investor-owned utilities, to identify the ways they can achieve the savings. When we originally passed the current version of our CIP, we allow utilities, we ask them to try to, they aspire to 1.5% savings on both the demand side and the supply side. And, if they get anything on the supply side, that would be over and above the 1%, so they can get up to 1.5%. If they can't achieve the 1%, we just ask why, and we have what we call like the soft landing and the off-ramp provisions. The overall 2% goal that we articulate as an overall statewide goal, overall, is just a statement of policy that in and of itself is a goal. It's not a requirement.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, can you show me where in the bill it makes clear that this is just goal setting and not mandate? I'm reading new language that says must include, must be. Can you point out for me where it makes it clear that this is just a goal and not a mandate?
I'll have to ask help from...
I'll ask the two of them to come back to the table. Keep Mr. Gerber, just slide over a little bit, pull more chairs up.
So that's an existing, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, that's an existing statute. I don't know that it's in the actual bill in front of us. We'd have to look at the larger CIP law. But we do have language, which I recall from when we passed the bill, that when a utility can't achieve the savings that they identify in their plan, they can state why they were unable to achieve those savings.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I'm looking at Senate File 1098, and I'm seeing language that says must include line 2.4, must be line 2.6, go back a ways, must be 6.25. Those sound like mandates to me. Am I wrong?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, like I said, those are for the filings. Those are for their plans to achieve those savings. And if in fact they can't achieve those savings, they're able to file an explanation with the commission as to why.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, so where in this bill does that make all of that clear?
Senator Brown, like I said earlier, that's an existing law. You have to crack open the statute book and find exactly.
Mr. Nissen, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, Senator Dibble is correct that how we currently implement our conservation improvement programs is that there's no penalty if utilities don't meet the goals that they laid out. We're simply asking them to, in their plans, file programs that are designed to meet 0.5% annual energy savings. The rest of the section 216D.241 lays out how those plans work, and then there are further examples in at the department and the PUC and our regulatory system and how those programs are implemented and tracked.
Senator, let me ask a big overview question to the whole thing, because Mr. Evans and I'm hearing what everybody's saying. I'm trying to figure out, they are required to provide energy optimization projects of 0.5% a year, and they have to be cost effective. And like Otter Tail Power says, they can't find enough of them to do that, and that's where the off-ramp comes in. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. These are, the bill is designed to capture cost-effective energy optimization projects. If a utility is not able to find those, and I just want to point out that combined heat and power is one option utilities can use. This is not a mandate to implement a certain amount of combined heat and power by any means. And so the way our conservation improvement programs are implemented, the utility does not find projects that are cost effective, and that's the baseline for how these projects are evaluated. And there is an off ramp and there's flexibility in that.
So, and Senate Counsel is saying on page 6, line 30 is the off ramp. They're not required to make the investments to attain them if they're not cost effective, even if the investment is necessary to attain the goals. Is that what you're talking about? Mr. Evans, could you?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I do want to point out, however, on line 7.30 and 7.31, the criteria for cost effectiveness for these systems hasn't been established yet. So that's something that, you know, in other words, we're not competing against replacing LED light bulbs. We're competing, I mean, there's going to be a whole new set of criteria, which is required because, frankly, it can't compete with typical conservation as an energy efficiency. So that's why we need a new cost-effective standard, especially for, in this case, for combined heat and power.
Mr. Evans, are you saying the same true for voltage regulation, energy storage, other ways of getting the supply side?
Well, I guess I see that part in the bill. I'd have to go
that's
back through the rest
out
of the
more
bill.
Detail. That's what I wondered, because nobody's been talking about some of the other sources. That was just good. Mr. Gerber, I'm sorry there aren't enough.
No, that's okay. I'll just push him out of the way. I think, and that's actually one of the concerns that we raised, and I know the bill authors are willing to look at it. I think one of our concerns is that what cost would actually be considered. It's important to distinguish between regulatory costs, and the PUC looks at those, which are potential for future costs coming down the line, and the obvious one in that is environmental regulations versus actual system costs. Our concern is if you start putting theoretical costs, regardless of whether you think they're real or not, but if you put those theoretical costs in, you're really going to probably err on the side of making unnecessary investments that otherwise would not be cost effective. So I think one of our concerns, and I know I'm going to work with the authors, is try to actually list out what those factors are, because I think right now there's way too much leeway in there on what could be considered cost effective or not.
We'll maybe take, you know, Senator Osmak had his hand. Maybe we'll try and wrap this up then. We're not acting on the bill today, but I think there is some issues that both sides can do some talking about, because I think there is clearly disagreement in what the language is doing, and I think that would be worth fixing. So, Senator Osmak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Senator Dibble, this has been brought up many times now. I think we're all concerned here in Minnesota on what the effect of 111B is going to be from the federal government. If this bill is, in essence, a book of suggestions, not actual requirements, but a book of suggestions, why would we want to, as a state of Minnesota, begin suggesting until we really know what the truth is going to be from the federal government as they bring 111D down on us?
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmak, I don't know that the two are mutually exclusive. I mean, we're getting a pretty good handle on what the federal requirements are going to be of Minnesota under 111D. To the extent that we're going to have to do more than we're doing today, we need to be looking at ideas like this. So the two, I think, can and should be, and we should be somewhat proactive at looking at strategies, particularly if those strategies result in energy savings and are cost effective.
Mr. Chair. But Senator Dibble, my understanding is prior to a lot of these requirements being put into place, energy producers, and this may have been many years ago, back into the last decade, far before I was here, that they were making conservation steps that they're not being given credit for. In other words, that they initiated what you're talking about, but then, and I can't give you examples, but that Xcel and other producers actually did start down that path and then were basically bushwhacked because they didn't get credit for them as the implementation came into play. Aren't we following that same path with this book of suggestions?
Well, I can only respond the way I just did. I don't think the provisions of this bill are going to be in place. There's clearly a lot of work that needs to be done, as is called for in Section 5. And I think, the 111D process continues to occur, and we'll have a pretty good handle by the time any of this gets into place.
I think what we'll do is I will encourage both sides to clarify some of this is just language. What are you trying to do, and what the concerns about are? Some of it's just, well, I don't think this is what it says, and some of it's disagreements, I understand, but I wonder if we can, when we will be laying the bill over now, and I wonder if I can ask the two sides to do some more talking on it quickly in the next few days. With that, I think we'll, Senator Rosen, do you have a question on this or
yes.
comments on it?
Yes, I did, actually. We'll comment and a question, if you don't mind. First of all, Mr. Evans, seriously, a summary? That's a summary? That's
what you're glad you didn't bring the full report?
Yeah, that's wow. Also, I almost hate to admit, Senator DeDibble, but CHP is a little sexy, I have to admit. However, this book, you're supposed to laugh at that comment.
Well, I always try to make the joke that energy efficiency is sexy and no one laughs.
No one laughs either. What's the problem? Yeah. But the big elephant in the room is 111D, and my concern is that we are going to be penalized some way for all the work that we've done in Minnesota, whether it was our renewable energy standard or something aggressive such as this. So, I mean, we really have to be very careful what we do until we know what's coming down from the feds. And as Mr. Evans mentioned, and I do agree that I think, we are sending some mixed signals here, and we need to clarify what is a mandate, what is a goal, because we've seen that before, and I think there is great angst in this room about that. My question, though, to you, Senator Dibble, is, right now, you're increasing the SIP goal to the co-ops and munis to 2%. Is that correct?
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, no. Senator Rosen, I'm not.
The CHP is not, Mr. Chair. CHP is not with the co-ops and munis, but I understand the Conservation Improvement Program goal is to 2% for the co-ops and munis.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, no. The co-ops and the munis are not touched in this bill.
Okay.
In any way,
okay, because yeah. They are having a very difficult time, Mr. Chair, making those the 1.5%.
Right.
But my note, my question, and I am getting to a question here, Mr. Chair, is there a fiscal note on this Section 5 with involving the DOE? And what is, shouldn't there be some comments from the department about this bill? I would assume if they have to do. Come out with a plan, a methodology for attributing savings. There's going to be some FTEs and some kind of fiscal note.
Is Mr. Grant or somebody from the department here? That's good. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Martin. Apologies, Bill Grant cannot be here. We have not been asked for a fiscal note. Oh, apologies. Allison Grebner, Department of Commerce. We have not been asked for a fiscal note, Senator Rosen. And the department does not have a position on the bill at this moment in time. So that's about all I can say this time. Okay. We'll definitely be engaged with stakeholders, and we have been working and met with Fresh Energy and
NC
on the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Senator Dibble, you will be asking for a fiscal note on this for Section 5?
Sure. Usually they just kind of show up on my bills.
Okay.
Like, where did this, come from? Yeah.
Whenever you ask for a fiscal, they might come. When you don't ask for them, they just show up.
Yeah.
It's magic.
Senator Weber, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. With that, I'm going to lay this bill over, and I'm wondering, Senator Scalzi, because we are coming back later, can you, is your bill quick to go through? I know we have PCA folks here. Is yours a long, lengthy one, or?
I have a testifier from out of town.
Could we have you present and have that testifier? At least that would be helpful, I think. Then we'll go a few minutes past 1:30, then, and we'll take that bill, the bill up, minus her out-of-town witness afterwards. So if you have other witnesses, we can do them later, but let's take at least...
So, Chris.
I see you have somebody from...
Oh, no.
Senate File 1132. Welcome to the committee, Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, I do have a testifier from out of town. I hate to make him wait around until 4 o'clock. So,
you want to do a brief, go through the bill, and then do a real brief, however you want to do it. I know you have some amendments.
And how much time do we have?
How about we do 10 minutes?
Okay. So is Senate File 1132... relates to solid waste management and recycling in Minnesota, and it's brought forward by the counties. I have two author's amendments. One is the A3 amendment, and one is the A4 amendment. And the A3 amendment relates to the collection and transportation of food. It just recognizes it as a important waste management element, and also speaks to the anaerobic digestion part of the bill. And then the A4 amendment, which you may not have in your possession yet. Well, first of all, I should...
Sir Scalzi, why don't you move the amendments?
Yes. The A4 amendment is to...
Why don't we deal with the amendments later, since
okay.
We're not handed out.
All right.
Why don't we just explain the bill briefly the way you want the bill to look when it's done.
Thank you. Well, first of all, we received a report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. You know, we get these quite frequently. And so we know that there's lots of things we can do in Minnesota to work toward better management and recycling of solid waste. And this bill addresses some of these. It's brought forward by the counties. Recycling is changing, and we've got these goals of 75% by 2030 for metro counties and 35% for outstate. So we've got a long way to go. And there's basically three parts to the bill. The first part is broadening the use of SCORE funds. The second part is moving the solid waste tax, the portion that goes to the general fund, back to the environmental fund. And if you want to look at your solid waste bills at your house, it's 9.75%. You're paying that tax. And if you have a business, it's 17%. The 30% of those tax dollars go to the general fund. And this bill attempts to move those back to the environmental fund to be used for SCORE grants. And then the third part is providing for a study to increase recycling markets. We have a letter of support from Conservation Minnesota in your packet. And the League of Minnesota Cities also supports the bill. So, but here to explain the bill is Ramsey County Commissioner Victoria Reinhart, who is also the, she'll tell her title.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Victoria Reinhart. I'm chair of the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board and a Ramsey County Commissioner. And I also chair the Environment, Energy, and Land Use Committee for the National Association of Counties. Thank you for the opportunity to explain the bill. This is and why it's important to all counties in Minnesota. And as Senator Scalzi stated, the League of Minnesota Cities also supports this. And Craig Johnson asked me to state that up front to make sure so that you could save time and didn't have to listen to it twice. On issue one, which information is found on page 2 of the handout, you can see that organics are primarily food waste, plant materials, and soil paper. And based upon the recent solid waste composition study, organics represent over 40% of the waste stream. It's important and critical to counties in meeting the state's goals. Counties need more tools for organic management. This proposed legislation will allow counties to use SCORE dollars for composting and also to support education and services related to food waste prevention and collection and transportation of food donated to humans and to be fed to animals. For example, in Anoka County, over 3,800 tons of food waste is collected by hog farmers from schools and grocery stores to feed pigs, hogs, I guess. In 2014, Second Harvest delivered 4,800 tons of food to people. In addition, programs supporting organics that are transferred to anaerobic digesters to recover biogas, with the remainder becoming a compost, are important new developments for counties to educate on and support. On issue number two, moving the solid waste tax revenues out of the general fund and into the environmental fund to fund SCORE, that is found on page one of the handout. Each year, 30% of the revenues on solid waste, over $21 million, are deposited in the general fund and are used primarily for non-solid waste activities, which is what they were generated for. Through 2014, SCORE funding to counties was $14.3 million. Since 1991, Minnesota's county's portion of the SCORE funding has been stagnant. Since its inception, counties have been obligated to match 25% of SCORE dollars. And in fact, counties spend five to six times more money than they receive from SCORE out of their funding sources for recycling, over $50 million a year, and that does not include the municipalities, the cities and counties funding. I skipped over one thing. I'm trying to go through this very quickly, and that is I do want to make sure that I remember to thank you for enacting a small increase to SCORE last year. We are so grateful for that. The bill before you deposits in 2016 and 17, 25% of the solid waste tax into the general revenues, and in 2018 and 2019, it goes to 20% that continues to be deposited in the general fund, and by 2020, no further solid waste tax dollars are used to fund the state's general fund. Instead, these funds are dedicated to SCORE. And finally, on issue three, a study to increase recycling markets in Minnesota, you will see in the legislative auditor's report that that is one area that they really focused in on. 800,000 tons of recyclable materials are still deposited in landfills. These are Minnesota resources generated in Minnesota that could be used to create products and jobs and conserve landfills and natural resources. We all support recycling and increasing recycling, which includes management of organics. However, as identified by the legislative auditor report, few resources, only one person is dedicated to market development. We concur with the auditor's recommendation for increasing the amount of resources dedicated to market development. Feedstocks, for example, represent unique challenges, and market development is needed for all the components of the waste stream. We need plastic markets, and there are at least 9 different plastics that offer different market opportunities. An important one is agricultural plastics, where a market has yet to be identified. And then there's paper, cardboard, tin, aluminum, and glass, brown, green, and clear, plus organics that have been composted. Contamination of the feedstock is just one of the issues. The issues are complex, and thus we are recommending a study to better target Minnesota's efforts for what is a global marketplace for each type of recycling. Thank you for your support and for enduring my speed.
Thank you, Ms. Reinhardt, for going through it quickly. Mr. Fryhammer.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Fryhammer. I work in the Environmental Services Department at Stearns County, and I'm also president of the Solid Waste Administrators Association, an affiliate of the Association of Minnesota Counties. I appreciate the opportunity to comment briefly on Senate File 1132 on behalf of both associations I mentioned. Statewide in 2013, counties spent nearly $62 million on solid waste management. Of those $62 million, approximately 55% are from county service fees and county general revenue. Making up roughly 25% of that 2013 funding was the $14.25 million in SCORE funding from the state. Counties are very pleased and appreciative with the increase of SCORE authorized by the 2014 legislature. For Stearns County, our hope is to use that increased funding to improve our current programs and better serve county residents and businesses. However, like much of the state's infrastructure throughout the state of Minnesota, county solid waste management infrastructure is in need of repair, replacement, or increased capacity. These are transfer stations, waste-to-energy facilities, materials recycling facilities, and landfills, all very large expenditures for counties. Additionally, counties remain concerned over funding for their own unique challenges, whether that is meeting the 35% recycling rate for greater Minnesota counties, 75% for the metro counties, or developing an effective organics program, or finding markets for the materials collected at recycling facilities. Solid Waste Administrators Association appreciates Senator Scalzi for introducing this bill as another effort supportive of counties' efforts to meet obligation and challenges for solid waste management in Minnesota. Counties have and continue to work hard to meet the mandates set in statute to promote public health, safety, welfare, and the productive capacity of the population. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Freiheimer. Questions from members of the committee? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scalzi, I'm looking at Section 3, and if you could just remind me, this, the 2030 recycling goals, is that goals that the legislature has already adopted?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, yes, we adopted those in 2014.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi, was there an appropriation in that bill for anything like studies, or was there any appropriation in that bill?
Mr. Chair, you know, I'm not sure if there was. There's an appropriation in this bill for a study from the general fund, but as I stated before, there's 30% of our recycling, our solid waste tax goes to the general fund, so it would be an appropriate disbursement from the general fund to come back to do the study. I do not recall if there was appropriation.
There
was not.
Thank you.
Last year's bill had the appropriation from what came out of the general fund to the counties, but there was nothing for a study in there.
Thank you.
There any other questions from the committee? We hit Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Freiheimer or Senator Scalzi, can you tell me, how does the SCORE funding go out to the counties? Is it fairly well dispersed? Is it per tonnage? I mean, is everybody getting their fair share?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, there's a base funding for every county, and I believe, off the top of my head, I believe that's $55,000. And then after that, the balance is then distributed by population.
And I want to ask quickly, because I know there are a couple others who were listed as testifiers. Can any of them not come back this later today? Okay, well, we'll assume they can. And
actually, Mr. Chair, there were other comments. We had a meeting last night and worked out a lot of those comments, which are, I believe, are prefaced in the amendment. So there may not be as much testimony based upon the fact that we have the two amendments.
You have several amendments. So, okay.
Right.
Well, we will take them up this when we resume the committee. But if members can shove their papers in their packets, it'll maybe help a little bit so we have it there. With that, I think what we're going to do is recess until 4 o'clock in this room. No. We're recessing the committee until 4 o'clock in room 112 across the hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
It's so warm over there. That's where we were last night, okay. Senator Osley. Tell.
I can't put the one.
I know.
All right.
We had a little fishing game. We were trying to get done with fishing game.
No, you didn't.